morning's panel is titled Tort Reform and Insurance Reform, Past, Present, and Future. My name is Pat Kilbane. I'm going to be serving as the moderator for this panel. I'm the president of the Jacksonville Lawyers Chapter. I was a shareholder at the statewide law firm of Gray Robinson, and I currently own my own wealth management firm. Our firm is called Ullman Wealth Partners, and we're located in Jacksonville Beach. We manage approximately $1 billion in client assets, and I do a little expert witness work on the side as well. So great to be with you all. And I want to congratulate Lisa, Abby, and her staff for the 10 years of this Federalist Society Conference. There are several of us who've been here since the inception, and it's just really awesome to see this conference exponentially grow, and I'm very excited to see what the future holds for FedSoc in Florida. And I'm also very excited about this panel. So without further ado, I want to jump in, and I will introduce the panelists beginning to my left. Our first panelist is Kansas Gooden. Kansas is a board-certified specialist in appellate law and an AV-rated attorney. She's a shareholder at the law firm Boyd & Jenneret, which I knew her when she was in the Jacksonville office, but Kansas is based in Miami, and she appears in courts throughout the state of Florida. Kansas has extensive experience handling all types of civil and appellate proceedings, and she's handled over 400 civil appeals. Fun fact about Kansas is, and we'll have to fact check this, but Kansas is one and maybe the only female that's argued back-to-back cases before the Florida Supreme Court on the same day. Kansas is extensively involved in state and local bar associations. She's presently the chair of Florida's appellate practice section and is the vice chair of the Florida Bar's Board of Legal Specialization and Education Committee, and she's a commissioner on the 11th Judicial Circuit Nominating Commission. Kansas is a frequent lecturer and travels the state presenting seminars and presentations on various topics to those in the legal and insurance industries. Kansas, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Our next panelist is William Large, who's the president of the Florida Justice Reform Institute. And for those of you who were at our very first statewide chapter conference, you'll remember a very, very interesting presentation that William gave at that conference. I remembered, and we were just talking earlier, and William said, everything that I presented on 10 years ago, we just passed. So I know that this is super exciting for William, and I'm glad that he's serving on this panel. But under William's leadership at the Justice Reform Institute, they've delivered notable successes on numerous and complex legislative, regulatory, and judicial issues. These have included repealing Florida's one-way attorney fee statute and reforming the contingency risk multiplier, strengthening the rules of evidence for medical damages, providing COVID liability protections for healthcare workers, and adopting the federal summary judgment standard, among many others. Before he began his service as the president of the Judicial Reform Institute, William was Governor Jeb Bush's deputy chief of staff, and he was responsible for a portfolio of health and human service agencies. Before that, he was general counsel for the Florida Department of Health, and during that time, he served as the director of the governor's task force on professional liability insurance. Prior to working for the state, Mr. Large was a partner in a practicing attorney in professional malpractice litigation defense. Mr. Large has 5 degrees, his bachelor's, his law degree from the University of Florida, and he's got an MBA, a master in political science, and a master in risk management and insurance from Florida State. William, thank you for being here. Our third panelist is Fred Karlinski, who is the co-chair of Greenberg's Global Insurance and Regulatory Transaction Practice. And, you know, just thinking about that, for those of you who know Fred, can you imagine Fred being the co-chair of anything? Doesn't really jive, but Fred has over 30 years of experience representing the interests of insurers, reinsurers, and a wide variety of other insurance-related entities. He's recognized as an authority on national insurance regulatory and compliance issues. He's taken a leadership position in many insurance trade organizations and has been listed in the Best Lawyers in America, Super Lawyers, Florida Trend, and Florida Trend's Legal Elite for his work in insurance law. Fred's recognized as the only Band One Florida insurance lawyer by Chambers and Partners and one of the most influential leaders in Florida politics by City and State Florida and Influence Magazine. Fred has in-depth knowledge of insurance compliance matters and has been a primary strategist in virtually all types of insurance-related legislative initiatives. In addition to his role with Greenberg, Fred has been an adjunct professor at Florida State since 2008, and since 2014, Fred has served on and currently chairs the Supreme Court Judicial Nominating Commission, where five of the current seven sitting justices of the Florida Supreme Court have had to go through Fred to get their job. Interesting fact about Fred, Fred went to the University of Miami and graduated in 1989, which to the Notre Dame alums in the room, begrudgingly, we have to admit that that was a heyday of Miami football. Well, for those of you who are old enough to remember Jimmy Johnson as the head coach of the University of Miami, he had a TV show on Sunday mornings following the games, and Fred Karlinski was the student TV producer for the Jimmy Johnson show.
That was fun. For 2 years, they wanted me to get
So, Fred, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Our next speaker is a longtime friend of mine. He serves as the Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives. Paul Renner represents District 19, which encompasses Flagler counties and St. John's counties. And he is a military veteran, a former prosecutor. He's a business attorney at the statewide law firm of Nelson Mullins. He began his career as an assistant state attorney, during which time he prosecuted serious felony cases. Since 1998, he's represented individuals and businesses and has advocated them and represented them in broad range of commercial disputes. In addition to his legal practice, Representative Renner has served as a naval officer, both on active duty and in the reserves. He was deployed as a combat veteran in Operation Desert Storm aboard the USS McInerney, and later during combat operations in Afghanistan in 2011. Representative Renner, he got his undergraduate degree from Davidson College, and his law degree from the University of Florida College of Law. And with all of that, I know his most proud title is husband and dad to his two young kids. So, Representative, thank you for your amazing service. I can probably say without qualification that Paul will go down as the most consequential speaker of the Florida House of Representatives. So thank you, Paul. Last but certainly not least, and this is really a full circle moment for me, I'd like to introduce Notre Dame Law Professor Jay Tidmarsh. 22 years ago, when I was a 1L, my very first law school class was from Professor Tidmarsh. And he, at that time, that was the fall of 2002, he brought into class a box that he wrapped up, and he said, in this box is an invention, and it's responsible for X number of $X million of revenue in the United States, but it's also responsible for north of 50,000 deaths. And so on the last day of class, he unwrapped the box, and before he did that, he took a bunch of guesses from the class, and we were all wrong, and he pulled out a Big Mac container. So that was the invention. At that time, that's when all the lawsuits were going against the fast food companies for their harmful invention of the hamburger and the fast food. But Professor Tidmarsh is a national expert in complex and civil litigation and civil procedure. He joined the faculty at Notre Dame Law School in 1989. He received his bachelor's degree with highest honors from Notre Dame in 1979 and his JD magna cum laude from Harvard Law School in 1982. He's a member of the Wisconsin Bar. He practiced as a trial attorney with the Torts Division of the United States Department of Justice from 1982 to 1989. He served as a visiting professor of law at the University of Michigan in 2000 and at Harvard Law School in 2003. He's a member of Phi Beta Kappa and the American Law Institute. He teaches primarily and principally in the areas of civil procedure, complex civil litigation, federal courts, torts, products liability, and remedies. He's the author or co-author of 13 textbooks, including casebooks in the fields of civil procedure, complex litigation, as well as numerous law review articles in the fields of civil procedure, complex litigation, federal courts, and torts. He served as chair of the AALS section on civil procedure and a member of the AALS Committee on Professional Development. Personally, Professor Tidmarsh has been a friend for nearly a quarter of a century, and there's lots of fun facts about him, but my favorite is his second child won the National Spelling Bee when I was a 3L, so that was really cool. All right, so welcome to our panelists, and let's get started. So my first question, and William, I'm going to have you kick us off. How did we get here? Why are we here?
Yes, thank you very much, Patrick. I think at its fundamental core, what we're talking about is who is the public policy-making branch of government? Is it the legislative branch, or is it the judicial branch? With respect to one segment of those issues, tort reform, the Florida Justice Reform Institute took the position that the proper public policy-making branch of government is the legislative branch. And for a long time in Florida, basically since the mid-1990s up through about 2019, you saw a fight that was taking place between the legislative branch and the judicial branch as who had that proper making role to make public policy in the state. And I think for a long time, there were those within the judicial branch that thought that they should be making public policy. And what we did is we took an issue on tort reform, and we examined several cases, several issues, and brought them to the proper branch of government to make a decision about who should make public policy in the state. So we looked at issues that passed on House Bill 837, which had eight substantive issues in it, and then another four issues. Now, these are complex issues that they don't happen without leadership support. So none of this would have happened without the leadership of Governor Ron DeSantis, Speaker Paul Renner, President Kathleen Passidomo. So you to get something like this done, you basically need three green lights from all three leaders. But once we got that done, we were able to advocate in front of the House and the Senate with respect to these issues. So what did we do? Number one, multiplier reform. The legislature adopted the federal standard for multipliers. And in a sense, we also gave life to the dissents that several courageous justices had written over the years. For example, the dissent that Justice Kennedy had written in the Joyce decision, that basically was adopted in House Bill 837 by going with the federal standard for multipliers that they should be used only in rare and exceptional circumstances. And that's what Justice Kennedy had argued in his dissent in the Joyce opinion. And likewise, looking at two previous cases that had set out the law on the multipliers, the Roe and Quantrum case, which had a lot of factors in it that made it very easy to get a multiplier on top of a lodestar fee, that the federal standard was the better standard, and that's what was adopted. Likewise, the legislature looked at one-way attorney's fees, and what we as advocates showed members of the legislature is that there was a plethora of litigation over low dollar amounts that benefited attorneys and were not benefiting the insureds. And numerous attempts to fix that over the years just simply didn't work. And we needed to focus on what was the heart of the matter. Why was that phenomenon happening? And it was because of the one-way attorney fee statute. Then we looked at the statute of limitations, and the statute of limitations in Florida for a regular garden variety negligence claim was 4 years. That was moved to two years. Then we looked at third-party bad faith, and in my opinion, this was probably one of the biggest cost drivers for insurance litigation in the state. You had people really when three things were present: low insurance limits, clear liability and extraordinary damages. No self-respecting plaintiff's attorney wanted to accept the low limits. Instead, they wanted to set up an insurance company for a third-party bad faith case. And there never seemed to be a time that an insurance company could tender the limits that the plaintiff's attorney was asking for them. So there'd be a terrible, horrific accident, and plaintiff's attorney would ask for limits to be tendered within 5 days. The insurance company would tender in 10 days or sometime thereafter, and that was never quick enough, and that would therefore be end up being a third-party bad faith case. Where did we draw the inspiration for what we did? Just from Justice Wells' dissent in the Burgess versus Infinity case, from Justice Kennedy's dissent in the Harvey versus Geico case, and we gave life to those dissents, and essentially now there is a objective time frame for when an insurance company needs to tender rather than a subjective standard. Next, we looked at something I call transparency of in damages, addressing an issue which was the bane of every insurance defense attorney's existence. They knew about this, letters of protection. And these were used by plaintiff's attorneys to artificially inflate past medicals through a promise to pay a doctor in the future when a verdict or settlement came in. But these letters of protection did not reflect actual reality in terms of of costs. So what we tried to do to members of the legislature is to explain, look at what this letter of protection costs, and we used real examples, and then compared it to what real medical costs were in terms of Medicaid, Medicare, workers' comp, usual and customary, to show that the letters of protection were not grounded in reality. In fact, were just meant to inflate the overall value of a case. And of course, the overall value of a case tends to be about 3 to 4 times past medicals. And the bigger the past medicals are, the bigger the overall value of the case is. So there was some major reform in that area as well. And then likewise, the referral of the injured person to the treating doctor, that was protected by attorney-client privilege in a case called Worley versus YMCA. And in that case, we gave life to the dissent of Justice Polston, and that was a dissent joined by Justices Kennedy and Lawson, saying that this was not legal advice, and so it shouldn't be protected by attorney-client privilege. And likewise, in terms of the calculation of future medicals, we gave life to the dissent of Justice Polston in the Jorg versus State Farm case. We also addressed two issues in the premises liability space, intentional tortfeasors on a verdict form with respect to negligent security claims. There, we effectively overturned the 1997 Merrill Crossings case, and then also created a presumption for apartments if they do certain things, that will be used as an affirmative defense. And then finally, modified comparative fault was adopted. And then there was four other individual bills dealing with lawsuit advertising for non-lawyers, okay, such as legal aggregators. Statute of repose was reduced from 10 years to 7 years. Auto glass assignment of benefits was addressed, and telephone solicitation was addressed. All those issues, 12 in total, were done because of the leadership of the gentleman to my left, Speaker Renner, Governor DeSantis, and President Pasadomo. But at the end of the day, Patrick, when we argue, at the Federalist Society, what is the role of a judge? Okay, it's the role of a judge to say what the law is, not what it should be. Well, where should we argue that someone should make those policy making decisions? It should be in the legislative branch, and that's exactly what we did. So those of you who are involved in other arenas of law, whatever it may be, education law, criminal justice issues, what have you, if there's a statutory basis for what you're doing, try and move that argument to the proper policymaking branch of government, the legislative branch, and let the representatives of the people make those decisions. And that's really fundamentally what we ended up doing this year, thanks to the leadership of Speaker Renner and others.
William, thank you for that awesome, comprehensive unpacking of the substance of our new tort law. Fred, I'm going to pass the baton to you. So as one of our chief strategists, tell me your role, explain to the audience your role in the process, and just how difficult was this to make it happen?
So thanks, Patrick, for putting this together, and to the Federal Society and to the leadership. Thank you for putting this conference together. It's important for us to exchange ideas and talk about things that are important to the state. Let me echo William's comments about the man sitting next to me. We have had for the last 10 years, and really maybe even longer, a plethora of things that happened in the court system where the legislature should have been in the lead for these types of things and for these types of reforms, and it just wasn't happening. And so you had a situation where you had a governor who was always there and who would always be in a position to want to do things. Governor Scott, certainly when he was governor, was in that position. Governor DeSantis was as well and has been. The Senate, who's typically more moderate than the House on these types of things, was really there. I mean, they wanted to do tort reform. They understood that some of the things that happened in the court systems perverted the role of the legislature in making the laws in the state of Florida in an extreme way. But the House, for some time, has not been there. And so, even though he's sitting next to me and this might be uncomfortable, I don't want to minimize, and I want to make sure people understand that really the governor was there, the president was there, but it took the man next to me to get this done, and we all owe him a huge debt of gratitude for doing that. Because it's not easy to get 120 people into a position where you can pass something. Certainly there was divisiveness there between, in large part, the Democrats and the Republicans on this. But here's what I would say to you. For a long time, attorneys' fees have ruled the roost. If you go back and you think about it, we had mold. It's interesting, I didn't realize mold had never existed until it existed in the late 90s in the state of Florida. But when you added attorneys' fees to that mold, that became a cause celeb. Well, the legislature did away with that, and mold has in large part gone away as a cause of action. Similar to that, you had a situation where cracks in tiles, cracks in driveways were sinkholes. Well, everyone knows what a real sinkhole is, and everyone knows how quick an insurance company would pay for a sinkhole. But because of unscrupulous contractors, lawyers, adjusters, and others, you had a situation where those sinkholes were costing not tens of thousands of dollars in damage, but tens of thousands of dollars in attorney's fees that we all pay for. And then in the last couple of years, we had AOBs, assignment of benefits, where you had contractors come in, keep the attorneys and the adjusters for the insurance companies out of people's houses, and you'd have a claim that should have never been a claim, turn out to be a huge claim in terms of a court claim, and then ultimately you'd see tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars of attorney's fees because of that claim. In the state of Florida, we had about 8% of all the claims nationally here. About 8% of all insurance claims were here in the state. Yet 80% of the litigation on the property insurance side was in the state of Florida. We had more litigation in this state by sheer number of cases than 45 other states combined. And so it was an untenable situation. And so you had the legislature nibble around the edges on this for several years. You had a assignment of benefits change where in large part there was a desire and an effort to take that out. That didn't work. You had an effort to create something called a notice of intent to litigate. That really did not do much. But until we passed the legislation that was passed, 2D in the special session of December of 2022, and then 837 last year, we really did not put ourselves in a situation where we were correcting the problem that existed in terms of the one-way attorney's fees. And so, in large part, I think what we did to get to the place that we're at now, which is a much better place, is we tried to dispel the notion that people were espousing that somehow this is just standard, or somehow these types of things defrauding your insurance company or this concerted effort to make a $10,000 claim into an $800,000 claim with legal fees was normal. It's not normal. People called it social inflation. I love the phrase when people talk about the homeless unhoused. That's like using the phrase social inflation. Social inflation is fraud, pure and simple. And the interesting thing about insurance fraud, I used to say when I was giving speeches, insurance fraud is not a victimless crime. Well, a group that I'm involved with called the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud has a much better tagline. It's insurance fraud, the crime we all pay for. And we really do. If we think about the rates that we're seeing today, those are all as a result of these one-way attorney's fees and these runaway verdicts that we've seen in the court system. And so I think to the point that Jesse made last night, William made just now, and that I've tried to make on the JNC and in other forums, having branches stay in their lane is critical. And so it is unfortunate that we've had to spend the time we've had to. You have 11 insurance companies that in the last 4 years, in a historical fashion that's never been seen anywhere, go out of business. You have a state residual market in Citizens that's supposed to be the market of last resort that at its high watermark of last year because of these insolvencies had 1.4 million policies. Those are perverse circumstances that can only take place when you have some runaway things happening in a branch that frankly should have never been involved in some of these things, because from our standpoint, we think the legislature's been clear in what they've intended. But I think 2D and 837, if it wasn't clear before, make it pretty clear that there is no, the one-way attorney fee statute is dead, and a number of the other things that William talked about have really changed and should change the game. One of the things that we've seen, if you think about this state, it's been built on two things. It's been built on tourism and real estate. For those that did not understand this or get this, let me make it real clear to you. The insurance market was on the verge of collapse because of these one-way attorney's fees, because of what was going on in the court system. As I mentioned earlier, 11 companies went out of business. The real estate market in this state was about to crumble because of lack of availability and affordability of insurance. Many people will say now that insurance is not affordable in the state. Many people will say it's not available in the state. And it's hard to deny that. We're in a situation where we are recovering. Rome was not built in a day. This problem didn't happen overnight, and it's not going to end overnight. But I think the work that the legislature did will get us to a much better place. And so I applaud the work that Governor DeSantis did, the legislature did, and some of the folks at this table did as well, to try to put ourselves in a situation where we not only kept this market, the insurance market, intact in the state, and it's been bruised and battered, but that we actually saved the economy of the state. Because if you think about it, that's what we really did.
Fred, thank you. One follow-up. When do we expect Rome to be completed?
You know, it's not going to happen overnight. The way insurance policies work, they're typically on the homeowner's side, and that's what, in large part, we're talking about from a crisis standpoint, property insurance, 12-month policies. So you had to have those new things go into effect and roll into policies upon renewal. I would say to you that it's pretty interesting that there were 300,000 lawsuits filed almost immediately after the passage of 837, but before Governor DeSantis signed that bill. But we are seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. We're seeing less litigation here in the state of Florida based on insurance claims. We are actually seeing, and we got sort of lucky, and this is beyond the scope of this, but let me just explain it to you. The way reinsurance works, that's not a Florida-specific thing. There are Florida-specific issues, but it's really worldwide. And if you think about some of the things that have happened worldwide in the last couple of years, the inversion of the euro and the dollar, interest rates rising actually hurts availability of insurance and reinsurance. Also, and I know causation is not something that we want to talk about here, but climate change is happening. And obviously no one in this room wants to have Leonardo DiCaprio flying on his G4 and talk about our carbon footprint. And so once we get once we leave issues of causation aside, we understand that climate is a concern to the insurance industry, and inflation has been a concern. But we're seeing some light at the end of the tunnel on all those issues. The reinsurance renewals that happened in January were the best reinsurance renewals we've had in 4 years, and so we're hopeful that with the reinsurance market getting a little bit better, with the reforms that we've done, which have been recognized in places like London and Bermuda, where insurance business is done, that the marketplace in the next 24 to 36 months will get better. Caveat there, and this is a sort of public service announcement to you all, look at your insurance policy. Most of them on your coverage A are not valued properly. So whether rates will go down or not is something that's pretty speculative, but just having the availability of insurance to me is the carrot to all of us for doing this, because without that availability, you don't have the economy that we have in the state of Florida.
Okay, before I get to the speaker, Kansas, I'm gonna go to you now. You've really been instrumental in this effort. You've been boots on the ground. You represent insurance companies. Tell the audience what your role has been in this process, and what you feel, if you could pick one thing, is the most consequential piece of this new law.
Absolutely. During this process, I served as an expert resource for numerous legislators and trade groups. I talked to them about what was actually happening in the court system, because I think unless you are boots on the ground, it is really hard to understand. Fred mentioned that Florida has 79% of all property damage litigation, but that is only, Florida has 9% of all property damage claims. So put that in perspective. And it goes beyond property. For instance, Florida has 31% of all personal injury litigation in the nation. Everybody comes to Florida to sue. And why is that? Well, it's a lot of the stuff that was coming out of the court system for decades. It's also, we have one of the most sophisticated and well-funded plaintiffs bars in the country who spend a massive amount of money on advertising. Just some statistics. Between January and August 2022 alone, trial lawyers spent $94.6 million on advertising. Yeah, let that number sink in. That is a huge part of our economy. They are trying to get in the legal system to sue. So a lot of what was done was talking about why our court system is so bogged down, why we can't get motions on our summary judgment timely. It's because of this problem. And so a lot of what I did was focus on that and talking about what was happening in the court system. I helped draft bill language to assist with that, and really just served as an expert for those in the process. And in my opinion, the most important thing that we were accomplishing is the basically getting rid of the one-way attorney fee statute.
And so, in Kansas, for those in the room who aren't insurance lawyers or plaintiff's attorneys, explain what that is.
Okay, so in Florida, when you as an insured or your assignee, such as your assignment of benefit person that you're giving to a contractor, if you sue your insurance company and recover $1, you get your insurance fees for the entire lawsuit. So Florida was one of the only states that had this broad grant of attorney's fees. And this is a huge risk for insurance companies. So when that came out, we looked at all the states in the country and kind of how they dealt with this issue. So most states, and this is a huge number, basically limit fees for when a insurance company denies insurance coverage for a claim. And it's not for every, you know, you're arguing about a kitchen cabinet. It's nothing like that. And there's 15 states in the country that limit it to solely finding an insurance company acted in bad faith. So we were this huge outlier in the country. And so what we did with HB 837 is brought Florida back in line with the majority of the company or the country.
Okay, Speaker Renner, over to you now. I got to witness your ramp up to the speaker and everybody who came to you, and they wanted to set your legislative agenda. You've accomplished a lot. Why did tort reform make it to the top of your priority? And just you know, share with everybody here how it all happened, how you made it happen.
Sure. Well, it happened because we really, really needed it. So in Florida, no income tax, you know, A+, number one in education, A+, very fiscally strong with our reserves and so forth. So you had all these things where Florida is just knocking out of the park, and then you had our ranking as a litigation hellhole by people that followed this climate. And so it was one of those things that frankly had held us, one of the few things that had held us back. So that's why it was on the agenda. Fred mentioned and others about how precarious our property insurance market was, and we dealt with that in the session, the special session, two special sessions actually, one before I came on as speaker and one immediately after, to address that and really ended that wild west of litigation in property insurance so that we can start to mend the market. And it, obviously property, while I'm on that, is like a big ship. I was a Navy guy. You have a big ship that's turning in the wrong direction. You can lay the rudder over, but it only stops and slows the bad direction of that boat until it starts coming back around. It is starting to come back around, but it's not at that point yet where the consumers are starting to feel it. But we also wanted to look beyond just property insurance at the market generally. Kansas gave some statistics, you know, and take a look at HB 37, which was an approach to say, look, we had these other bills that were running and construction defects and AOB glass and so forth, but let's look at this from a broad standpoint rather than going after a particular industry or appearing like we're favoring a particular industry. Let's just look at it in the abstract and what do we need to fix? One-way attorney's fees, all the things that William kind of outlined, and put all of that into one bill. So those seven things that were in that bill, that's how that originated, and it started really just over the summer looking at all the possible levers we could pull to bring that in, what other states were doing, where we were, to try to bring ourselves, and what I feel, and of course everybody in this room is the reasonable man or woman, and everybody else is more or less so, but you know what appeared reasonable during those discussions that we should put forward. And of course the sponsor, Tommy Gregory, added on the 4-2 statute of limitations, and also we got some premises liability language in as we began session that we thought was really helpful, and added that into what began as those other five. And then, you know, it's always easier to kill a bill than to pass one. And when a bill is consequential and as transformational as this tort reform bill, it's kind of like a scene from Indiana Jones. You know, doesn't matter what movie, there's always that scene where he goes through this gauntlet, and you know, if he steps in the wrong place, the poison darts come out, fire's coming down from the ceiling, and there's a big boulder rolling behind you, and you have to do it all pretty quickly. That's a 60-day legislative session for something like this, and if you don't have all the stars aligned, and we did, then it's easy not to happen. So another thing that I knew was necessary is how we approach the strategy, and that is, to Kansas's point, about $100 million in advertising, that if you roll this out, you know, in the first committee week, and you've got, you know, 3 months before you even get into session, you will die a death of 1,000 cuts, or in this case, 100 million cuts. And so we knew that, so we got our ducks in a row and put the bill forward, hit a couple committees, hit the floor, went to the Senate, went to the governor, signs it, effective, you know, normally our bills are effective July 1, that's when the fiscal year starts and whatnot. Sometimes that's later if it's criminal justice to get everybody time to adjust, but we can, and we did in this case, say it's effective upon the governor's signature. And so the moment he got the bill, signed the bill, it was in law, so that those policies that turned over after that date, or new causes that, you know, new claims that arose after that date, would be captured by these new reforms, and we would see a little faster benefit. And so so those were things we looked at to make sure that this got done. And I also talked to business people who, if I'm being honest, if I had to ride into battle battle with one cavalry, I'd go in with the plaintiff's lawyers, because they know exactly where they are. They're very well prepared. They do an excellent job. They're likable. I mean, you know, and I feel like I'm in the middle of the fairway on this, but the business community is so often divided. And so the best quote I can give you is, you know, and this is very true of insurance, everybody knows they want to paint the house, but nobody can agree on the color. And so when that happens, you always lose to the united party. And so that was another factor, in addition to never having all the presiding officers and the governor kind of lined up, And so what I did is I went to all the business folks and said, listen, you've got, you know, this bill that is particular to you and serves your particular company's self-interest. This year, this bill is your number one priority. And it's got to be everybody's number one priority. We're all going to swim together, row in the same direction. And then the final thing I would say that we did that made it successful was to, as conservatives are often want to do, you know, guilty of doing, is we think with the, you know, the side of our brain that's all about data and cost-benefit analysis and logic and not the emotional side. And politics and life and humanity is a lot about what pulls us emotionally. And so there are a lot of really tragic stories about the bankruptcy. Nobody feels sorry for an insurance company, right? I mean, let's be honest. But we had truckers that came forward and came to the podium in press conferences to say, look, we're going out of business. We've spent more and more money for less and less coverage. We're getting to the point where we're going to be just self-insured, and that's not a good position for us to be in. We were able to tell stories about being, you know, rear-ended while they're waiting on a train to pass at a railroad crossing and got sued and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend those cases. It's cases like that that then pull the jury, if you will, of public opinion your way. And I think that was very, very important, because what the plaintiff's lawyers are very, very good at, and we want them to be good at, in cases like opioids or, as you know, I care a lot about social media and kids, we want them to go after these bad actors that know things are addictive, they know they're harmful. They're really, really good at persuading juries and bringing that emotional argument. So we had that component as well, and it was those things that really, I think, led to a brief shock and awe and success and getting that done, and we're seeing the benefits. This year, in talking to an auto insurer, they said their overall claims are down 41%, and in the glass area, you heard about AOB Glass, this cottage industry that we had with windshields. You know, you come out of Publix and you got a crack in your windshield, you know where it came from, and a guy comes out and says, would you like some steak knives and a free windshield? And there was a lot of that happening and a lot of just really frivolous litigation, and those claims are down 200%. So help is on the way, as Fred mentioned, you know, inflation, cost of construction, these kinds of things in the property insurance market certainly are things we can't control, supply and demand. But getting rid of Wild West litigation, bringing Florida in what I believe at least is the middle of the fairway where good claims can still be brought, and we can get out all the garbage is where we want to be and where we are now. And then, of course, on property insurance, we're working on mitigation and things like that to bring down severity so that we have a reasonable price for that product.
Thank you, Speaker Renner. All right, now for a different perspective on our new tort law. Professor Tidmarsh, you have sort of a national review, and you've become familiar with our new law. So I open it up to you to share any thoughts that you have on our new law.
Sure. Thank you, Patrick, and thanks to the Federal Society for inviting me. So my last experience in a tort case in Florida was 1985 up at Tyndall Air Force Base. So I don't know much about the particulars of of tort practice here in the state of Florida any longer. But what interests me about any tort reform, I was in the Reagan Justice Department at the very beginning of tort reform and did a little work on it. What interests me is what's exportable. In other words, what about this particular piece of tort reform legislation might work elsewhere around the country? So that's one of the perspectives that I have. And I intend this not as a criticism at all, but this particular tort reform bill strikes me as incremental or a bunch of different specific issues and practices sort of unique to Florida that it was attempting to address. A number of them, like moving the statute of limitations down to 2 years from four, it's pretty common around the country. That's where the statute of limitations already is. Moving to a modified form of comparative fault, I think those two are two of the biggest set pieces of the tort reform legislation. Most of the country was already there. I think 35 of our states were already at this modified comparative fault. So in terms of, you know, what is exportable or what does this signify in terms of the continued direction of tort reform, I'm not sure. In other words, again, a couple of the biggest set pieces were just simply bringing Florida more into line with much of the rest of the country. And a number of the other pieces, like bad faith insurance litigation, which you've already heard, was I wouldn't say uniquely a Florida phenomenon, but obviously a lot of the litigation seems to have been concentrated here. So I don't know in terms of the how much or how easily what's done here is exportable. One other thought that I have quickly, I have thoughts on some of the one-way fee-shifting statutes, and more particularly on the lodestar, the change in the calculation of the lodestar. But we professors are we're programmed to talk in 75-minute blocks, and I don't want to do that. So perhaps if it comes up in questions, I'll say something about that. But just one larger thought about torts in general. And that is, if you break it down, I mean, what the tort system says is act reasonably, act like the reasonable person. And if you don't, you pay for it. That's sort of the fundamental nature of torts. So I spend 40 classes telling that to students, but you can say it in a minute, what the tort system is about. And the question of then who determines reasonableness, or who determines the dimensions of this. I know a number of the speakers have mentioned that these are really legislative judgments or legislative policy judgments. And I have a somewhat different view on that. I think some of these issues are legislative judgments. Some of them I'm not as sure are legislative judgments. I am a Democrat, small d, Democrat. In the sense that I really do believe in legislative supremacy and the legislature's ability to determine or set the law of a particular state. But I'm also a traditionalist. Torts is a common law subject. It's a subject that has always said, just act reasonably. And I'm also a great believer in direct democracy to the extent that we can. We don't have a lot of direct democracy. One of the few places we do is enshrined in both our federal and state constitution here in Florida, is with juries. They're one of the few places that they actually get to say to us all, this is how we think people in our society should act. This is what we expect reasonable behavior to be. So when I look at the tort reform legislation, any tort reform legislation, but including Bill HB 837, some parts of it I think are clearly within the legislature's prerogative. A statute of limitations, by definition, is a statute, and therefore has always been within the legislature's prerogative. Some of the other features of the bill, which were attempts to put a thumb on the scale in terms of what constituted reasonable behavior, perhaps the 90-day waiting period on bad faith claims, or a tender period on bad faith claims, some of the presumptions in favor of no liability in the event of in sort of multifamily residential areas. I'm a traditionalist. I'm a direct Democrat. I would personally like to leave more of those issues to juries rather than to the legislature. And that's just my own view about the balance that exists between between the legislature and the judicial branch of government, within which I include juries. They are themselves juries, a part of the checks and balances in our system, and they check and balance our legislature and our judicial branch both.
Thank you, Professor Tidmarsh. Anyone on the panel care to respond to any of Professor Tidmarsh's comments?
Yeah, thank you, Patrick. One of the things that I think I want to paint a picture of sort of the mindset that traditionally the trial bar has had, traditionally the organized left has had about public policy. They see public policy as a triathlon, okay? They see the legislative branch, that's the swim. They see the executive branch, that's the bike ride. They see the judicial branch, that's the run. And on so many different issues, whether it's because they're saying the need for a case should be reviewed by a jury, they see it as, okay, we've lost the issue in the legislative branch, so we were behind during the ISWIM. We lost the issue in the executive branch, so we were behind during the bike ride. And we lost the issue in the circuit court, We lost the issue in a district court of appeal, but we're going to win that at either the Florida Supreme Court or the last stop in terms of the run. Okay? So that's how they view public policy. And if that's the case, what is the point of the legislative branch? Okay? Elections matter, and those public policy decisions should be made in the legislative branch. Okay? So that's sort of the different sort of zeitgeist or mindset that the progressive left has about public policy that is different than I think it necessarily should be. Number two, and I think this is very important, and I don't know if that I'm gonna be given the opportunity again, and this message is to the judges and justices that might be in this audience. The importance of dissents. The dissents aren't just for the parties in this case, but they're read by people like myself who can take them to policymakers like Speaker Renner and say, you know, Justice Polston, Justice Kennedy, Justice Lawson, Justice Cantero, Justice Bell, this is their outline of how this matter should have been treated and how this issue should have been decided. And it's amazing, for example, so many members of the legislature, they know who Justice Kennedy is, and you present them with a dissent, and you have to summarize it for some of them are non-lawyers, but that is extraordinarily important, and that is something that I think is very important. And then next is the issue of the long game on all these issues. A lot of times people that me and Fred will deal with, they'll say, well, we don't think this issue can pass this year, so we're not going to do it, okay? Lots of times the audience that me and Fred are speaking to at a legislative committee, we're speaking to freshman member Paul Renner, who will later become a chairman, who will later become the speaker. So it's very important over time to lay that foundation, and sometimes you're going to push some of these issues and they're not going to go anywhere on year one or year two, year three, but you've got to do it over time. And then the final issue that I think is very important to put out there is you need the people in this audience, attorneys, to give examples to people that advocate in front of the legislature to effectuate change. So just let's look at letters of protection, for example. The legislators needed to see a real letter of protection, how it was introduced into evidence, comparing it to what occurs with Medicaid, Medicare, usual and customary charges. So it's like you're trying a case in front of a jury of 120 House members, 40 senators, and one governor. And of course, the governor, speaker, and Senate president are like super jurors on that. And you've got to explain those issues to them in that way. Same with third party bad faith, with time limited demands. We kind of use cartoon examples of when the accident happened, when the demand was made, how quickly the insurance company tendered the limits, and the insurance company saying, yes, this is complete negligence. This is a clear liability fact pattern. We are tendering the limits some 10 days after the accident, not after a complaint being filed. But nonetheless, there was a bad faith case set up. So that's critical and that's important. And that's how I believe, we bring these very important issues to the proper branch of government, the legislative branch, to determine, which, by the way, they say no all the time, right? Speaker Renner and others have said, no, we're not going to move this bill. We can't get a sponsor. It dies in its second committee of reference. That happens all the time, and that is effectuating the will of the people through their elected representatives, and that's okay. But that's where that debate should be happening.
I wish I had William's patience, but William, thank you for your work. Professor Tidmarsh, before I go to my last question for the panel, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to the policymaking triathlon and see if you had any thoughts on that.
I don't run triathlons. That's my first thought. I think it's a more diffuse picture. And again, I do not deny the supremacy of the legislature. If it wants to make a policy change, it's competent to do it. I'm not suggesting that. But as I said, I am a traditionalist. And for centuries, judges have made policy in the tort system. And so I just think it's a more complicated situation in the context of the tort system. If there are particular difficulties shared, of course the legislature can step in, and as I think William said, it's often going to be the case the legislature is not going to step in a particular circumstance. In many instances, what I'm really worried about is continuing to preserve the role of juries to be able, in particular cases, to say this is the society in which we would like to live.
Okay, lastly, before we turn it over to questions, question for anybody on the panel who wants to jump in. With our tort reform law, what did we leave on the table? What's next, if anything, is next? So anybody who wants to tackle that, go ahead.
I have an entire list of wants.
I'm stunned.
While I have Paul Renner here, I think our state needs to still do more on this subject. I think reasonable caps on certain types of damages, non-economics specifically. I know Representative Yarborough has did a strike-all amendment on a Med-Mal bill trying to get the caps back in. I also think we need attorney advertising reform. There is a direct correlation between advertising and lawsuits filed. In 2013, there were two federal cases that overruled and struck two advertising cases or advertising rules in Florida. So if you look at 2013 to 2022, the number just grows astronomically. I also think, you know, third-party litigation funding, which I know William's working on right now, disclosure on that, and I also think we need responsibility in that area. Require those litigation funders to pay fees, costs, sanctions, payments to the court, everything that a potential plaintiff could be liable for.
Patrick, right now there's a bill committee substitute for Senate Bill 248 by Senator Yarborough trying to give life to the sense that Justices Kennedy and Polston wrote in the McCall case from 2014 and the Calatan case joined by Justice Lawson on the caps on non-economic damages, which would actually, Senator Yarborough wants to move it to a per claimant cap rather than an aggregate cap. But that issue's out there. Third party litigation funding is out there. Asbestos reform is out there. So those are three issues that are still alive midway through session for this year.
Right. And William, I think all those are critical and things we need to deal with, but to the point Candace mentioned, something needs to be done with the attorney advertising. It's insane. I mean, what I've said to people in other states when I've given speeches there after we passed 837 is that this is coming to a state near you, because it is. These folks need to go somewhere. They will go somewhere. I'm on the Orange Bowl Committee in South Florida. At our meeting last May, I just happened to be sitting next to the CEO of most of the radio stations in South Florida and the person that ran advertising for two large TV networks. And I was asking them how everything was going. And they were both nervous. I said, why are you guys nervous? They said, well, the trial bar has come to us, basically. They're our main advertisers, and they're pulling back. And they're pulling back because of that legislation. So I applaud the legislation. I applaud the fact that maybe the airwaves won't be flooded. But as Governor DeSantis pointed out, these are billboard attorneys. And we're seeing that every single day. And the fact that we had multipliers and other things out there because there's a lack of attorneys to cover these things, you just need to drive up 75 or the turnpike and you're going to find someone. And frankly, as a professional, when you tell someone you're an attorney, it's demeaning that they think that's what attorneys do and that's what we're all about. So I'd urge us to think about that. The other thing I would say that I think there's not a lot we can do about, but I want to reiterate the point, the trial bar is by far the most organized and best lobbying organization in state capitals and DC. And for those that are in the business community, for those that represent the business community, we've got to get our act together. Ben Franklin said, if we don't hang together, we'll surely hang separately. Bottom line is, the trial bar hangs together every step of the way, and as Speaker Renner said, we're still trying to figure out what color to paint our offices. That can't continue. The insurance industry in particular is under an antitrust exemption. We can't talk about things the way the trial bar can do their seminars and reptilian discussions and things like that. And so we need to be better. And the trial bar not only participates in state capitals, but they're also participating in judicial elections. The business community doesn't. Whether, you know, we should have an elected judiciary or not is another story, but certainly their emphasis on making sure that they play in those races, to me, has certainly created a perversion at the trial court system, and I think it's something that needs to be discussed and looked at along with the attorney advertising.
Speaker Renner, any final comments?
Yeah, I would go back to what I said earlier about, you know, we all in the room believe we're the reasonable man or woman, and if anybody disagrees with us, they're a little wrong or a lot wrong, depending on how much they disagree with us, and I'm the same. But I would say we also have to be cautious about balance, so I would make Professor Tidmarsh happy to know that, you know, when it comes to a jury trial, some of the solutions are make everything mandatory arbitration, you know, basically get rid of the jury system. That is something when we looked over the summer at what are all the levers that could be pulled, that's just one that I'm not at all comfortable pulling, especially at a time where our elites seem to have migrated more and more in rejection of our core foundations. I'd rather go in front of 6 or 12 complete strangers any day of the week in 2024 is how I feel about it. And so, but make sure we're balanced. We don't want to go, you know, the business community comes in and says, make sure that nobody can file a lawsuit against me. And the plaintiff's attorneys come in and say, make sure I can put anything whatsoever in front of the jury. And as long as I can make them believe me, make it stick. And so we always want to be in the middle of the fairway for the golfers in the room. But I do agree on advertising is one thing that is offensive to me as a lawyer, because we're talking about cases and controversies. And so we always have to remember these are unique circumstances. And so that's why when we look at some things that are one size fits all, it's problematic. And this year, you know, I'm probably on the other side of the aisle on things like sovereign immunity, that, you know, we can't allow a government truck to run over your loved one and you get nothing. But if a FedEx truck runs over your loved one, you can recover. And so we always want to be balanced, but litigation financing, I know, is another one we're going to try to find a landing spot on, because now we have people like the CCP that are trying to use litigation through discovery to steal our IP, for example. And so these kinds of things have to be addressed. We have to find a landing spot. And of course, also let some of these reforms settle and see where we are before we move forward too much further.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And panelists, thank you. I'm going to open it up to questions. We've got about 10 minutes and four questioners. So questioners, keep your questions tight, and hopefully we can get to everybody.
Thank you, sir. Panel, for the time. On this last question, has any consideration been given to the contingency fee rules? And I'm thinking specifically maybe to Mr. Large's point. Multifamily, new development construction is important in the state of Florida. It's one thing when a single family claim can be brought on behalf of a homeowner, but when you can aggregate claims on behalf of numerous homeowners, you go from maybe a five-figure claim to seven and eight-figure claims. And so if you consider distinguishing purely personal injury cases from property damage claims, has any consideration been given to that, making a distinction in the rules of what attorneys can collect on a contingency fee basis?
Yeah, that is an issue that always percolates up to the top. The problem is right to freedom of contract, and then the regulation of the attorney profession by the Florida Bar, which is an arm of the judicial branch, makes attempting to address that issue in the legislature extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible. So that issue is not on any bill that I know that's moving, because that's so difficult. And it really boils down to right to freedom of contract. And if, you know, someone wants to get into a contract that 33% goes to attorneys, or 40% if the case goes to trial, you know, so be it. We are addressing something on the margins in terms of third-party litigation funding. We want to get some transparency there, particularly in difficult class action lawsuits where there may be a funder from a sophisticated hedge fund in the shadows. We want to provide some transparency there. So that's probably as close as we're going to get to that issue, even though I totally understand it, but there's, you know, issues with the bar and others that make it very almost virtually impossible to address.
Yes, sir, over here.
Hi, Sam Miarelli. I wanted to take up the professor's invitation to talk about Lodestar in this conversation because, you know, it's quite regular, whether it's in class actions or in these other contingent fee things, that you see plaintiff's lawyers claiming that their reasonable fee is $1,200 an hour or something like that, that you know that there's no corporation in America that's ever paid. And I wonder if the panel has any thoughts. I mean, there's some proposals out there, like maybe requiring the defense side to disclose their actual attorney's fees that they're paying, or maybe to get rid of the Lodestar altogether. And you know, you look at in the 11th Circuit with the Camden rules, I mean, effectively the judges go everywhere, but also they don't really have any other benchmark in front of them usually, because the defense usually doesn't want to disclose their fees. And so it's kind of a one-way information ratchet. And I'm just wondering if the panel has any thoughts on what we could do about that to rein that in.
Here's my thoughts on that. It's actually, I mean, the defense bar is charging relatively low amounts. I mean, insurance defense attorneys, some of them are getting $175 an hour, $225 an hour. That's not the problem. The problem comes in when expert evidence is introduced that Mr. Plaintiff's attorney's paralegal should get $600 an hour, Mr. Plaintiff's attorney should get $950 an hour, and that's the only evidence coming in front of the circuit judge, and the circuit judge, you know, says that that's a real number, and then that's multiplied by the number of hours in the case, and you're getting, you know, a very big number. I wouldn't be adverse to getting into what the insurance companies are paying the insurance defense attorneys, because that's actually a very low, reasonable number. The outrageous number that I'm seeing is the number being posted by the plaintiff's attorneys that ends up being, you know, using the Lodestar method, getting big fees.
And as an owner of a defense firm, I would have no problem with that, because it would actually make insurance companies probably pay us a little bit better. So.
Professor Tidmarsh, you were specifically mentioned in the question, so please.
No, I'm happy to pass on this one. I will make one observation, and I suspect that if with the reduction or the elimination in most instances of the multipliers, I wouldn't be surprised if the expert witnesses, given the relative efficiency of legal markets, they will now say that it's $1,200 an hour rather than $950, and you might end up in the same place at the end of the day.
Mr. Levine.
Thank you. Actually, my question also kind of relates to attorney's fees. Speaker Renner, you had mentioned that the law was effective immediately upon signing, and I think it applies to causes of action filed thereafter. But I'm curious, the bill obviously makes a lot of changes, a lot of substance changes, but also makes some procedural changes. For example, the right to how do you calculate a multiplier under the statute, which is a purely procedural mechanism, because it doesn't affect your substantive right to a fee, just how the court calculates your right. Would something like that be applied to all pending cases at the same time because it was a procedural change versus a substantive change? Or is that something the legislature considered?
We did. We settled on what I would say was a more middle ground, a less aggressive effort at retroactivity, if that's where your question's headed. You know, and again, there's you know, even on something that I think was pretty transformational, there's give and take there. And I agree with the professor's comments. Transformational for Florida, but we really, again, I think hit the middle of the fairway by being more where most states are on these things. But yeah, we did talk that through, and you know, went with a more middle ground, which is to the chagrin of those that are on the receiving end of those 300,000 lawsuits. I apologize for that, but
it's okay.
And I would add, you might get an answer to your question very quickly. There's a case pending in front of the Second District Court of Appeal called Torres versus Aponte. There was an order signed by Judge Moe that is the subject of that issue, whether or not the issues are procedural and then they would apply, or are they substantive and they wouldn't apply, or are they a combination of both and then maybe they would apply. And So that issue is probably going to be answered by the Second District Court of Appeal within the next year. And just so everybody understands what happened, there was a big bubble of cases filed right before March 24th, 2023. And the plaintiff's bar at some point almost gave up on lobbying this and just got the message out, any case in your office, file a lawsuit to try and avoid the effectiveness of this law, which shows to me how effective it was in that seemingly at least 100,000 cases were filed in a bubble before the law went into effect. Do some of those cases, are the procedural aspects going to apply? We're going to get an answer probably to that in the next year, but it shows that this must really work if they file that many cases to avoid the law.
Thanks, Eric. All right, sir, final question.
Can I follow up on that real quick, too? And I think Torres, and there was an earlier case called SAP that I was appellate counsel on, that also Judge Moe wrote a fantastic order. Shout out to you. The procedural portion had to do with boarding medical bills. So it was not about attorney's fees. And so that portion of the analysis is probably going to be coming later. But retroactivity is something that's being litigated all over the state on numerous portions of this bill.
All right, thank you.
I would just add to Indiana Jones to my left here. We understood how tough this was, and although there would have been some things we would have liked to have done differently, again, we appreciate what was done because this is transformational. While to the professor's point, a lot of these points are Florida specific, if it takes Florida out of being a judicial hellhole, it did a heck of a lot that people should be proud of.
All right, final question.
I wrote out a list. I think some of you may know who I am. My name's Hugh Lumpkin. I'm one of the other first tier Chambers insurance lawyers. Slightly different than you, Fred. I'm a litigator. And here's the issue. Last time I was here, I spoke on the American rule on attorney's fees. And we talked about Joyce and multipliers. So you have a sense of where I might be coming from in relation to what would, to me, at least on some of the issues you have discussed, been a hostile panel. I want to go directly to a simple point. Speaker Renner, you said good claims can still be brought. And the problem with that is they cannot. We have had one-way fee shifting on the books in Florida since 1897. Why? Because it enables people who cannot otherwise afford counsel to be able to bring a claim against an entity which can hire any lawyer it wishes and spend as much money as it wishes in order to contest the claim. The idea was you are going to level the playing field. So my dad, who is from the panhandle of Texas, might call this hunting rabbit with a shotgun. You did away with one-way fee shifting, notwithstanding the insurance industry, which, by the way, spends $12.51 billion a year on advertising, uses very aggressively proposals for settlement to accomplish the same thing. Is there any consideration being given to allowing people who cannot otherwise afford counsel to have a fee-shifting provision put back in so that, to use your words, good claims can still be brought by homeowners? We know that a lot of the cases that were filed in March of 2023 were roof claims, many of them under AOBs. And you know me well enough to know that I don't cotton to that kind of practice. But what I do know is buried within that 300,000 were a number of legitimate claims by people who could not otherwise afford counsel if there wasn't fee shifting. Is there any consideration being given to restoring that capacity with people who, by the way, are voters?
Thank
Just
you, sir.
Wondering.
Yeah. So we included and retained one way with respect to coverage denials where there's a total denial of a claim, which is important. And also, obviously, a proposal for settlement still on the table. So if it's a hogs get fed, pigs get slaughtered is still the law of the land in this area. So if somebody is demanding too much on the plaintiff's side, they can still get stung and vice versa. So I think those are two things that in my mind, as I was looking at the bill, are checks and balances for the concern that you raise, which I share, which is you got to, whether you agree with me that I'm in the middle of the fairway, you probably don't, you got to keep everybody honest. The genius of our system, and nobody knows it better than the people in this room in the Federalist Society, is our checks and balances. You have to have adequate checks and balances on insurers. You have to have adequate checks and balances on the folks on the plaintiff side if the system's not performing in an efficient way, in a fair way. And so, yes, I mean, I would say to you, and I made the comment a moment ago, in my mind, we're kind of letting things settle a little bit. I'm not down for, you know, getting rid of the jury trial system or, you know, caps on what the lawyers can charge their clients. And when you get into caps, you know, it's when you get into one size fits all type issues, it gives me pause because I don't know your case. That's why I also don't like the advertising, because, you know, so-and-so got me $700,000. Well, that's somebody else's case. That's not my case.
And I think I know who you're referring to.
Okay.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of them.
So we're gonna have to leave it there because we're standing in the way of lunch. So if anybody wants to talk to the speakers after the fact, thank you for your excellent question. And thank you to our panel.